You know, you may or may not choose to build a LEED building. Odds are around here these days you're going to build a LEED building, and we probably don't have to encourage you to do eco roofs. But you may or may not want to do that. You may or may not want to put in a water feature. You know, but and you may or may not build bike lockers, though many people are now building it much more than our base zone requirement for bike parking.
Bike storage.
So, but what we really want you to do is affordable housing, and that's obviously, Commissioner, the message you're trying to send here with this structure.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think we have to look at our existing bonuses in the context of the situation we're in today. And, you know, quite frankly, or quite simply, affordable housing is more important than bike storage, which is happening anyway due to market forces. Eco roofs, I think we're just in a situation where we need to at least, you know, maybe for a period of time, at least 5 years, strip away everything else and go with the affordable housing bonus, see what that produces for us.
I think we should just require eco roofs rather than doing away with the incentive. Just say, if you've got a flat roof, you need to have an eco roof on it.
Yeah. And just one other ingredient, you know, when you read the report, you'll see that for the historic transfer in particular, you could use some of these tools in specific places, because we're trying to incent preservation of the buildings in Chinatown and Skidmore district. So in our historic districts, it could be what's available there is the historic transfer, and so it prioritizes the use of that there. It actually reduces the pool of donor sites for transfers of FAR, increases the value of that for the historic. So we can tailor this program geographically as we get towards the end as well.
Let me see if this works. We had a big technology upgrade, so nothing works, of course. This report came out, I guess, either today or yesterday. So in fairness, none of us have had a chance to read it. And I think once we digest it and have a chance to continue the conversation, we'll probably have more detailed questions. It looks like from the schedule that you're proposing, we'd have another hearing sometime in the fall. Is that right, Dan?
July and then in the fall, right?
Well, yeah. The proposal, as I understand it, is that there's another hearing in July, but it's really sort of to give us initial direction. Whatever proposal we come up with will be adopted. Our intent is as part of the code adoption for the Central City 2035 plan. So, you know, that's we're still working on that. That's a year out before that's in front of you all. So, over that period of time, we have time to refine and vet and test whatever system we want. But I believe that Commissioner Saltzman's initial call for the next meeting was just to give us some blessing to go forth and try to do that.
So let me, in that spirit, so if we're coming back on July 9th, can I just put some questions on the record? And I don't need answers to all these. First, a suggestion. I think we all learned from the PowerPoint that this is a very complicated and technical subject. And it's unless you're in the development business, it's very hard to sort of follow all the terminology. And my suggestion is that we ask Jill Sherman to come on July 9th and do a, from a developer's point of view, do an overview of how a pro forma is put together. We did that when we did the big look, the update on the multi-program with the county a few years ago. And she called it sort of developer 101 for dummies, which meant it was targeted for me. And the goal was to sort of walk us through a spreadsheet and show how this actually works. So I would urge you to do that, because I think a real-world example is probably easier for us to understand. That's number one. Number two, I want to applaud you for putting a 60-year affordability covenant on the table. That's been the cornerstone of our preservation strategy. It obviously isn't what we get on either the tax abatement programs currently, because they're 10-year. We get a 10-year covenant for the benefit. A 60-year affordability covenant is swinging for the fences, and I hope we stay focused on that. I want to follow up on something Commissioner Fritz raised, and she framed the question of the 0 to 80 MFI around equity. I want to frame it also around need. We have a ton of data that says the biggest and most compelling part of the market shortfall right now is 0 to 30. The very poorest in our community cannot afford housing. They're just completely priced out. There are no options. We have a lot of anecdotal data about 60 to 80, and so my question is, since I haven't had a chance to read this document, do we have hard data on what the market conditions are for people at 60 to 80? Do we actually have a survey saying that in the same way we know that there's over 20,000 households priced out at 0 to 30, do we have data driving the assumption, put aside whether this program works, because mm-hmm. Commissioner Fritz's question and your answer got at the question of how you scale it might determine what kind of output you get. Putting that aside, do we have good data on the market needs at 60 to 80?
The Seto Housing Report, which is backed by data, shows that there's in the central city, there's no affordability for anybody making less than 80% of median family income.
Well, okay, that's central city, and our housing policy doesn't necessarily geared to making sure that you get to that every neighborhood is open to you. So what about the city as a whole?
In terms of
60 to 80.
No, the city as a whole, outside of the central city, it is affordable.
It is affordable. So, okay, so I want us to focus on that because the crushing need in our community is 0 to 30. It may be that under the analysis that you've done, you can't create an incentive program that gets you 0 to 30 units. But, and I appreciate that the proposal apparently says that it's geared to 0 to 80, but if you do a payment in lieu, it will go into a fund that's capped at 60%. That's progress. But I want to come back to this when we have the hearing. We know where the crushing need is, and I want to make sure that any incentive program tackles the need and not just the sort of want to have, the need to have. And the need to have is obviously people that are desperately poor. Third, you mentioned in passing, the gentleman who presented mentioned that some feedback from developers was that we should look at maybe expanding or modifying existing programs, and both the SDC waiver and the multifamily tax exemption. Were there specific proposals that developers put on the table, or they asked us to look at this as some part of comprehensive update on those programs?
I don't recall there being any specific recommendations out of those meetings and conversations. It was more about how the need for the Bureau of the City to look at those programs to make it more accessible or better utilized.
So the thing we often, you know, as my colleagues know, the big reform we did last time was we put a cap on the amount of dollars that we're going to that was applicable under the multi program. Under the tax abatement program, and we have heard that it may not be as user friendly as possible. At some point in the future, does the Housing Bureau intend to come to council with proposed changes to either of those programs?
Yes, we are going to ask. We have made simplifications to the multi process, but we also intend to ask council and the county commission to increase the foregone revenue amount from $1 million to $3 million, given the simplification of the tool and the fact that it is one of the tools that is more used than our other incentives.
Well, I wish you luck on that, Dan. As you know, the foregone revenue cap was what the county insisted on, not the city. So we didn't. That was not our issue when we did the big look, and it is as you know a big concern to the county. And if the county chair does not agree to lift that cap, then mechanically it doesn't work because the county the assessor has to agree to take the properties off the rolls. Javier, do you have a strong feeling one way or another as to whether money that goes into a fund, the payment in lieu, should be used to build affordable housing in the downtown area, or should be less restricted in where it can be invested?
It should be less restrictive. Our focus in terms of investments are in opportunity areas that are not just in the central city, but other parts of the city that have amenities and good schools, that it's a good environment for kids and families and people to live in.
And the other benefit of that, of course, is that by giving you a larger canvas to paint on, you have more options, because we can't at any particular time know for certain whether there's dirt available or a development deal. So is it the Housing Bureau's recommendation that the payment in lieu go into the HIF?
Yes.
Okay, and then so there's the
HIF being Housing Investment Fund.
Right. And then the housing targeted through the HIF would be somewhere between 0 and 60, correct?
Correct.
Now, in the conversation we had recently about Parks SDCs, which I vaguely remember, we had some folks in the development community that expressed a little bit of heartburn about the sequence and the timing. That is, particularly people that were in the pipeline to doing development but hadn't pulled a permit, who wanted to make sure that the rules didn't change in a way that either derailed their project or changed the cost. It looks from the schedule that you've given us that the earliest that this would come to council for a vote would be next summer. Is that correct? So it'd be summer of 2016 is the earliest we'd actually be adopting a change to our bonus system. Is that correct?
That would be the earliest, and actually it's part of the Central City 2035, so it'd be closer to the end of the year in 2016.
Okay, and that's just important for us, I think, to message to folks, because obviously people that are in the development pipeline, the first thing they ask us is, when might this change be effective? So currently, and at least through next summer or potentially late fall, our existing bonus system is in place. Is that right, Joe?
Absolutely. And so the effective date of this also depends on when our comp plan is. So there's a good lead time, Commissioner, I think is the short answer. And right before it goes into effect, we're going to see a flurry of projects under the existing bonus system. But that's just the way all these changes work. But people will have plenty of time to plan it into their assumptions.
And one last question. I think we're going to have a robust discussion from what I'm hearing in this work session about what bonuses should remain and what should be cleaned out and what are the values that we're trying to promote through density. One of the things that occurred to me in listening to your presentation is there's a couple areas where we could get our cake and eat it too, if you will. So, for example, there's nothing that prevents us from saying that any of the affordable units also have to meet the highest levels of accessibility, correct? So that, in effect, they're not only affordable, but that they would be the kind of housing that an older adult choosing to live downtown could actually live in?
I think it would just be economics. So, you know, you would want to make sure you do structure to the extent that that costs more. And I'm sure there's a marginal cost difference in the cost of construction of those units. I don't know what it is. You just would make the bonus work with that. But indeed, I believe you could do that, yes.
Well, and I think it's important as we're talking about the graying of our community, we're talking about older adults choosing to be here. We know that a lot of older adults tell us they like to be downtown in close to amenities. That means older adults, people with disabilities, and making sure that there's the highest standards of accessibility built into any affordable housing. So I would urge us to consider that. And then finally, you can create affordable housing, but if, as Commissioner Fritz notes, you don't target communities of need, you sometimes perversely end up serving the wrong people. Now, one way we address that in other parts of the city is we have mission-driven nonprofits that are partners, and they're targeting communities of color. They're targeting, in the case of we're finding with a new niche area, which is retirement homes for gays and lesbians, targeting a particular area. You can do that without running afoul of the Fair Housing Act if you have a partner and you're intentional. There's obviously a line. So I guess my question is, assuming we have a bonus system that does produce affordable units, how do we make sure that they go to the most deserving people?
It goes to what you just mentioned, Commissioner Fish, is about targeting and how do you strategize in working with our partners in the community to ensure that when units become available, we are able to send a notification to those partners so that they have equal access or sometimes even first knowledge of this unit's coming online. And that's what we're trying to do at the Bureau. Specifically, we're looking at the multi and should this come on board, the density bonus process.
So I think we're going to want to drill down a little bit on that, particularly since there was a slide earlier that said that developers are not so keen on mixed income developments. And I hope in that spirit that we are emphatic, Mayor, as a city, that we will not allow in any development downtown that takes advantage of this bonus separate entrances for people living in affordable housing.
Right. Good points. Let me double down on one of the requests that Commissioner Fish made, and that is you've obviously, David, had some good conversations with the development community already in developing the report so far, and that's great. I love your request about Jill perhaps developing
it. She really has it down.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand it.
I would recommend that. I love that suggestion. I would recommend augmenting that maybe with specifically consulting with some folks at the PDC, Bruce Wood in particular, to, again, let's see some real pro formas of at least solidly theoretical projects, if not real ones. excuse me, so that we've really vetted, because we often in these issues get into theoretical discussions energized by ideology. This time it would be great to get into a real analysis energized by real pro formas about projects that are as real as those folks can make them. So we've got some resource folks, obviously, call on each of our offices. We've got Jillian Detweiler in my office who's seen a pro forma or two in her time, Bruce Wood and his staff at PDC, folks like Jill in the private sector. We have a PDC commissioner, Mark Edlin, who's done a pro forma or two, and who in each case have in issues like this been able to turn these proposals into actual spreadsheets that we can look at and even we can understand, because I'm in the similar situation as you are. You know, I've been around real estate a little bit, but a pro forma is above my academic achievement. So I love it when somebody else can produce one and then explain it to me. So the more that we can do in this case, I think the more we can get real about how this is going to work, and we've got folks at our disposal, both volunteers and staff, who can help us with that.
I know that we're trying to skinny the list rather than fatten the list, but there's one concern I have, which is that we have a bunch of unreinforced masonry buildings in the central city. Some of them are historic, some of them are residential, some of them are low-income residential. We are in the process of developing regulations to require that all of these buildings be retrofitted at one point or another. And we're hearing from the owners of the buildings that since the market at this point doesn't really reward them for having buildings that will survive an earthquake, and because the cost of those retrofits can be high, that some of them might simply walk away from those buildings. And we've got, we had one committee working on developing what the regulations might be, another committee looking at what sort of financial incentives or assistance we can give people to help in those retrofits. And I know that at some point in the past year, I saw a BPS document that talked about the possibility of giving owners of unreinforced masonry, a seismically unsound building, bonus FAR, transferable bonus FAR that people could sell off to help pay for the cost of their retrofits. And that's something that I wouldn't want to dismiss out of hand as an option. Again, there might be some overlap. Some of them might be historic and able to take advantage of that specific option. Some of them might be residential, and so we might be able to figure out some way to loop bonus FAR for them into an affordable housing bonus. But there's going to be some buildings that the argument we'll hear is they'll either be left, be abandoned. They will be abandoned unless there's some incentives, some financial assistance for people to fix them.
Maybe on my part, but that's where I thought you were headed here with the historic side of this. So,
we started down that path, and we intend on continuing. Now that we know it's $33 per square foot, then our argument becomes how do we make sure that flows into, in a useful way, seismically upgrading, and what buildings are we going to target? So we have talked to PDC, who's done a lot of lending, and sort of that was our sort of source of information. We think that, you know, there's enough money, there's enough in that bonus to maybe work. So we are going to continue to look at that. And then Javier's made the point throughout the project about the importance and the possibility. A lot of our most vulnerable seismic buildings are affordable housing buildings in the central city, so there may be a way to hook those two up as well.
Right. No, it's exactly that.
So we'll continue to work that. And if you have this committee on financial assistance, Commissioner, that would be really helpful to us to consult with, because we have to think through the nuts and bolts of how this works. If it's a transfer, and I think this is what David was getting at, you know, our transfer system is that it's a private market transaction. And so we don't really know what transfer FAR goes for in the marketplace, because it's a private market transaction. And right now, there's lots of different sources of donor buildings, so there's lots of different ways to get your hands on some FAR to bring to your building. If we tighten up that system, if there's fewer types of donor sites, then, you know, you've affected the marketplace that way. But we still will never know how much money is really flowing to the building in return for the FAR they sell. So we may think it's worth this much, but the market may be willing only to pay a certain other much amount. And so that's probably the biggest design hurdle we face in thinking that one through, Commissioner.
Did you have another question?
Well, I have another comment. I did find the two pages in the report that cover historic preservation and open space. So in terms of direction on July 9th, I'm not sure I'm going to have all that much more information. I appreciate that discussion you just had. Obviously, you've done a lot more thinking about particularly historic preservation. I'm going to need some more information on the open space. On the historic preservation, we did hear in the West Quadrant Plan significant community concern for historic preservation, so that it will be hard to, say, go forth and just do affordable housing without having this one more fleshed out.
I understand, Commissioner. So, and also, when we developed this study, we worked closely with Parks on the open space one, and Brett Horner in particular. So you may want to talk to Brett about what he learned by working with us on this, but we can bring back more on open space as well.
Yeah, at the hearing, it might be helpful to have Brett from Parks and somebody to talk about historic preservation, just so that folks know that there were the three prongs that we directed to have more study. It does seem like one of the big questions is, at what level of affordability should we be targeting this bonus? And I expect a robust discussion about that at the hearing. I'm not sure. Is the expectation that at the hearing we'll be making that decision or giving that direction?
I believe we'll ask for direction on all the criteria that were listed in the summary here. And we will make sure that these voices are present at the hearing on the 9th, whether it's Jill Sherman or somebody like Mark Edlin, somebody who's certifiably smart on this, Brett Horner from Parks, Bruce Wood from PDC, and we'll get somebody on the historic preservation. But yeah, I think we have to, it may be a tough call and it may be an uncomfortable call, but I think it's a call we have to make, because we have to remember this is an incentive program. It's not a mandate. So we have to sort of find that line that's going to engage the private sector to produce more affordable housing, because we're not getting there with our public programs. And so it may push some of us out of our comfort zone to go to 80%, but I think if you look at the housing report, you'll see that 80% is, in fact, what is needed in the central city, and that if you consider the absolute magnitude difference in incomes, it's not significant between 60% and 80%. I know, you know, we want to conduct holy wars over these numbers, but if you look at the actual numeric differences, you know, a family of four earning $55,000 a year is 80% median income. And I think, you know, these are families we want to have living in the city, central city, as well as all parts of the city.
So, Javier, I'd like you, if you would, to compare the state of housing in Portland statistics for communities of color, the breakdown, and give us some metrics at the next hearing about, at $55,000 for that median income of four, what's the breakdown of the different communities of color that could afford that, so that we would know who is going to be benefiting if we set it at 80%.
J- Just to put the next hearing in context, it's a resolution to give us direction, and that we'll take that direction and we'll start to explore the nuts and bolts of these approaches, like I was talking about with seismic. There's some things to figure out, and we have to vet it with the public, because just as this study was just dropped on you all, it will be dropped on the development community and lots of folks, so there's going to be time to absorb it and take it apart. So in addition to the direction, whatever direction we get, you know, there's a full vetting that goes through a legislative process as well. And this is going to be one of the most examined parts of the Central City Plan, I believe.
And just finally, having served on the Planning Commission, I know how much time the Planning Commission has put in. I was wondering if Andre Barr had anything you wanted to add.
Andre Bod. Look forward to this committee. Through our commission. Obviously, affordable housing, we've talked about it. We've talked about it at the Central City and in the broader city context. I think the question of affordability and the 80% and the equity question around individuals is an important question. Looking at who benefits is important as you go through that process. Also, flexibility, from my standpoint, would be important, that being focused around affordability and the idea of narrowing your options in terms of what those bonuses are makes a whole lot of sense, so you don't give people a lot of opportunity to go off and do something else, because it sets a priority of what's important to the city in the future. But being flexible, and I would say flexible around how you spend the money, from the standpoint of saying, is it focused only on the Central City, or is it available for all of the city? But you can't forget about the Central City, because there's a huge need down in the Central City. So offering that flexibility. And lastly, I think making it workable, and the idea that you come back, because the market will change. If you look across the country, and I think your consultant will tell you, it changes. So what today looks feasible, developers say, yeah, this works. 5 years from now, 3 years from now, the market will change. 2010, people said, we can't even build a house. How do we do a bonus? Today, they can't build enough. And 5 years from now, it may be you can't build more. But the consistent message is there's still a need. And you're not going to solve the problem with this. And I think if you keep that in mind, you don't solve affordable housing with the bonus system. It's a tool in your toolbox, and it's one more tool. And how you apply it, and I think that's what we're going to look at. How do we apply it to make it the most effective in the city?
Thank you. Dan, thanks for bringing this conversation forward, and thanks to Javier and Joe for walking us through it. I think this is a fascinating discussion. Of course, with our luck, what will happen is next year the market will tank, and we'll go through the next inevitable cycle, which actually is, given the glut of units coming on the market, is probably more likely than less likely. And I appreciate your comment that this is just a tool. I mean, the irony in this discussion is we had a chance in this legislature to do something, legislative session around inclusionary zoning, which apparently is now lost. And without that tool, that's a tool that we could have actually put in place and made some progress. But if you add up all the pieces, if you add up everything and you continually fine-tune our toolkit, one family at a time, you're improving their situation, and that should be our goal. So I appreciate also, Andre, that you've just been a very vocal and persistent voice around affordable housing, and particularly around South Waterfront. I don't think the council would not have gotten to where we ended up without your advocacy. So thank you.
Well, thank you all, and I'd like to thank the Housing Bureau and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability for their outstanding collaboration, and our consultant EPS for giving us a great report. It's food for thought. It's certainly complicated food for thought, but I think if we sort of keep our eyes on the ball and what it is we want to achieve here, and that is, as Andre said, it's one tool. It's not going to be the panacea for creating more affordable housing in the central city, but it is one tool, and it's one tool that we hope we can calibrate to incent the behavior we want, which is the production of more affordable housing in new developments or payment in lieu of to our housing investment fund. So more to come on the 9th and in the ensuing Planning Sustainability Commission hearings, which will be, I'm sure, robust as well. Thank you all.